education unsurpassed in my private school for the upper middle class. I learned like each good Christian does how evil segregation was. But there was absence of variety and no uncertain terms. My cordoned off society was zero in the terms. On Martin Luther King Day, school was off and we would play our identical homes. Teens of Monaco in my little white town, I never had a black friend. Everybody was an Anglo-Saxon, but we all learned diversity is grace. Out of all those vanilla faces, I never saw a single one act. I used to pray at bedtime, hey, could you rig it? Bring me a little black friend so I can prove I'm no bigot. But my rich neighbors will tell you mixed blood lowers property value. They fear someday perhaps they'll pierce this suburban capsule. Defend the right of every man to prosper and improve. As long as they don't move to my little white town, where I never had a black friend. Everybody was an Anglo-Saxon, but we all learned diversity is grace. Out of all those vanilla faces, I never saw a single one act.
Yes, indeedy. My bud, Stuart Davis, he's going to be playing in Santa Cruz at the Crepe Place tonight. Now, the Crepe Place is really a very small and intimate environment to be doing a show in, but Stu will be there starting at 8. No, they're not paying me to make this announcement. It's a personal PSA. I'm going to be there and Stuart Davis will be there. Ah, don't you get tired of hearing about Stuart Davis on this show? Well, that's all right. Almost nobody listens to this show anyone. Hi, my name is Ren Tawil and this is the Mideast Madness Show. Which comes to you every Monday starting at 3 o'clock p.m. This particular show is April 8, 2013, so if you're listening to it as a rerun, having gone into radioforall.net, that's radio, the number 4, ALL.NET, or perhaps Santa Cruz Indie Bay, you won't be able to call into the show because it is indeed a rerun, but this is live based on the 6 minutes after 3, April 8th, time frame that I'm giving you. Okay, speaking of phones, I'll give you the phone numbers right now. I will be repeating them, so don't panic, don't freak out if you don't get them on the mark yet. Area code 831-427-3772. Likewise, there's another line, if you prefer. Same area code, 831-469-3119. This is indeed Free Radio Santa Cruz. Struggling, searching, striving but not yielding. We're going to need a new location for our radio tower soon, preferably in the western hills of the city of Santa Cruz, the west side. Current property is being foreclosed upon in about 7 or 8 weeks. We need a new location for a transmitter. If you can help, please give me a call or go to our website, freakradio.org, leave a message. examine the site carefully. There may be something on there pertaining to our need for a new tower location. As far as I know, we're also still looking for a new studio, one that we could afford a little more easily, so we can keep coming to you and bringing this marvelous radio service and my marvelous show to you every Monday at 3 p.m. Please consider supporting us financially. We need your donations. I and all the other people who do programs pay money for the privilege of doing this show regularly every month, except for the people who fall behind. I pay, I'm current, and I pay my dues conscientiously. The rest really does depend on you. Please consider sending your donations, however small, however big, to FRSC. That stands for Freak Radio Santa Cruz, but you can just put on the envelope FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, C-R-U-Z, California. The optical character reader symbol for which is capital C, capital A. Zip code 95061. That's FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Okay. Last Monday, I went into a pretty long explanation of why I do this show. I really cannot afford to continue taking up so much of the show's less than two-hour time frame to go over that. Suffice it to say, I am the son of a Palestinian Christian who was born and raised in Jerusalem, Palestine, the entirety of which is occupied territory under the Zionist forces of the State of Israel. My father, unlike so many of his countrymen and countrywomen and country children, who were chased out or killed by the Zionists in 1948. My dad was fortunate enough to be here in the U.S. on business, both business and family business, in May of 48. But because of what happened, of course, the Israelis would not allow him to return. They wouldn't allow any non-Jewish Palestinian Arabs to return. Their passports were rescinded and canceled. Their any rights that they may have claimed to have to their homeland, torn asunder, canceled. So my father, having lost all of his property and wealth, which he did not have with him here in the U.S., settled down, met my American mother, and raised four children. I came in second. That's where I'm coming from. This show is not intended to be an objective analysis of the Israel-Palestine and Israel-Arab conflict in the Middle East. Obviously, my bent is towards the Palestinian cause, but don't forget you can call. You can call me at any point. Don't worry about interrupting a reading I'm doing or music or anything. Just give me a call. Again, the phone numbers are 831-427-3772-469-3119 is line number two. Okay. We are indeed recording this show for posterity. I will begin. I have a lot of stuff I want to go over people with. I'll be concentrating on this week's show, this week's episode of Military Madness, on the status of East Jerusalem, and also another terrible economic and political crime, a big one, really big one, that Israel is perpetrating against the Palestinians who live outside of Israel, not to mention the ones who live inside Israel. I'll get to that later. Right now, let's do Jerusalem. folks. This is a piece that someone passed on to me. It is an email that she hadn't opened. It's dated. That's the original date of this. Okay, the piece is dated May 7th of 2009. And the person who passed it on to me, she finally got around to opening it. May of 2009. It is entitled Ethnic Cleansing in East Jerusalem. Is not a paranoid worry, is happening now. Please keep in mind, this is as of May 7th, 2009. Written by Bill Fletcher Jr., who is the executive editor of blackcommentator.com. Of course, this is from Black Commentator. Here is an introductory paragraph, which will probably appear later in the article. Then, of course, they can do it like the United States and New Orleans and use a natural disaster to remove its black population in one fell swoop. On the other hand, Israelis don't need the excuse of a natural disaster. They have the Zionist imperative. May 7th of 2009. Ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem is not a paranoid worry. It's happening now. The Israeli government often reminds me of a dog I once owned. My dog was forbidden to enter into the living room. Nevertheless, she would creep into the living room, usually moving a few inches at a time in order to see whether we reacted. If we did not react, she would move further into the living room. Sometimes, when she was in the mood, she would move so far into the living room that she would feel comfortable tearing apart the furniture. A recently released United Nations report confirms what many human rights activists have alleged. At least 60,000 Palestinians in East Jerusalem face the prospect of eviction by Israeli authorities. Remember, folks, this piece that I'm reading to you is dated from the middle of 2009. Continuing. Yet this story has received relatively little mainstream attention and even less official condemnation. Ever since the Israelis captured East Jerusalem in the June 1967 war, they have made clear their intent. Despite widespread international protest and clear violation of international law to annex Jerusalem. In order to expedite this annexation, the Israeli occupation authorities have put pressure on the Palestinians to, quote, vacate the premises, end quote. The pressure has included actions such as encouraging Israelis to settle in what had been Palestinian East Jerusalem, while failing to build new and adequate housing for the Palestinian people. The current trick of the Israeli government is to move against Palestinian residents by claiming that the Palestinians are living in homes that show no proof of a legal building permit. What is perverse about this is that the Israelis are not talking about housing built in the last several years, or even housing built since the June 67 war. They are discussing housing that has been occupied by Palestinians in many cases for decades. In fact, according to the Washington Post, May 2, 2009, the dispute even involves searching through archives from the time of the Ottoman Empire, which ended when World War I ended in 1918, in order to prove ownership. The Israeli government, of course, denies that they have any intent to ethnically cleanse the Palestinian population. How could they, of course, given that they are supposed to be the model of democracy in the Middle East? The reality is that what the Israeli government has been conducting in East Jerusalem is part of the larger Israeli strategy in its occupation of the Palestinian territories. drive the Palestinians from the best lands and replace them with Israeli settlers. Insofar as the world does nothing, the Israeli government behaves much as my dog did. It moves further and further in, increasing the intensity and scope of their destructive behavior. Again, I am reading from an article entitled Ethnic Cleansing in East Jerusalem is Not a Paranoid Worry. It's happening now. Written by Bill Fletcher Jr. of blackcommentator.org. Let's continue with the article. It should surprise no one that the Israelis are attempting to remove the Palestinian population from Jerusalem. This has been consistent since the June 1967 war. The extent of the projected removal, 60,000 people, should, however, outrage any democratic-minded person. Irrespective of one's stand on the history of the development of Israel and its conflict with the Palestinians, the fact of the matter is that the Israeli government continues to violate international law and precedent without having to fear any sort of international sanctions. The proposed removal of some 60,000 Palestinians increases the relevance and timeliness of discussions regarding the need to develop a movement to boycott, divestment, and sanctions aimed at undermining the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. Since it seems obvious that most governments, including but not limited to the United States government, are unwilling to take steps to insist upon justice for the Palestinians, then pressure needs to be brought about by squeezing corporations and governments that are complicit in the criminal activities of the Israeli government. Mr. Fletcher ends his article here. Silence in the face of ethnic cleansing is simply unacceptable. The Israeli government and its friends must understand that there is a cost involved when it snubs its nose at the Palestinian people and, in fact, at the world as well. BlackCommentator.com executive director and author of the article, Bill Fletcher Jr., is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, the immediate past president of Trans-Africa Forum, and co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice, put out by the University of California Press, which examines the crisis of organized labor in the USA. He is also on the advisory board of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. And can go to them on the web at www.endtheoccupation.org. By the way, this was initially sent to Portside at lists.portside.org. Who is Portside.org? Portside aims to provide material of interest to people on the left that will help them to interpret the world and to change it. Oh, such high-minded talk. At least we know what the intentions of the author and publishers are. Okay. This was written, as I said, a number of times now and released May 7th of 2009. Mr. Fletcher makes the analogy to the dog he once owned that slowly crept into the living room and, when not admonished to continue doing so, crept a little farther and a little farther until it felt comfortable, so long as no one got down on the dog's case to make it go outside and started ripping up the furniture. This figure of 60,000 Palestinians in East Jerusalem, I first heard 70,000, I think shortly after this was published in 2009, were facing the prospect of eviction by Israel. An underlying current of this whole article is that Israel continues to do what it wants to do in order, in order to fulfill its self-induced Zionist destiny of an all-Jewish population, 100% Jews in the state of Israel, to eventually occupy all of historic Palestine and perhaps more lands beyond that, such as southern Lebanon, the Sinai Peninsula, which Israel invaded twice. Three times, if you want to count the 1973 war, where Egypt attempted to take their own land back. Perhaps the westernmost part of Jordan, on the east bank of the Jordan River, that kind of thing. The Golan Heights of Syria that Israel still holds on to. That's the underlying theme, that Israel does this and gets away with it. And not nearly so much for survival purposes, in order to maintain the existence of the State of Israel, but for their own expansionistic agenda. That is what has been demonstrated all these years and decades. And, of course, the U.S. not only does nothing about it, the U.S. government is part and parcel to Israel's crimes by consistently and continually, many times over, exercising its veto power on the Security Council of the United Nations, vetoing censures, sanctions, and attempts to reverse Israel's misdeeds. The U.S. just vetoes. And if any one of the five permanent members of the Security Council, which was put together at the end of World War II, Russia, France, Great Britain, China, and the United States, if any one power vetoes, then the whole resolution goes down the tubes and disappears. Goes nowhere. All right. Let me read that last paragraph again so we can update the situation. Silence in the face of ethnic cleansing is simply unacceptable. The Israeli government and its friends must understand that there is a cost involved when it snubs its nose at the Palestinian people and, in fact, as I was just saying, at the world as well. May of 2009. After reading this, I took the initiative in researching the current status of Jerusalem. I have, I believe, three pieces on that. And all of these three pieces are much more recent, either written only a matter of months ago or were written a year or two ago and republished. The legal status of East Jerusalem. Very quick, short review. In the first couple of weeks of June 1967, Israel invaded those portions of historic Palestine, or former British Mandate Palestine, that they did not succeed in taking by the beginning of 1949 by military force. 67 pretty much put a cap on the whole territory in the favor of the Israelis. Having occupied all of the western half of the city of Jerusalem, including the Old City, or parts of the Old City, in 48, Israel captured the rest of the city of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, in 1967. Legal status of East Jerusalem and its residents. This was published on the first day of January 2013. Let's see what's happening in Jerusalem now after that four-year-old piece that I just read to you. Bit of history. Between 1948 and June of 1967, Jerusalem was divided in two. West Jerusalem, which covered an area of about 38 square kilometers and was under Israeli control, and East Jerusalem, which contained an area of some 6 square miles, which was ruled by Jordan. I'm sorry, 6 square kilometers. West Jerusalem covered an area of about 38 square kilometers. East Jerusalem, some 6 square kilometers, ruled by Jordan. In June 1967, following the 67 war, Israel annexed some 70 square kilometers to the municipal boundaries of West Jerusalem and imposed Israeli law there. These annexed territories included not only the part of Jerusalem that had been under Jordanian rule, but also an additional 64 square kilometers, most of which had belonged to 28 villages in the West Bank, and part of which belonged to the municipalities of Bethlehem and Beit Jala. Following their annexation, the area of West Jerusalem tripled, and Jerusalem became the largest city in Israel. Prior to 1967, therefore, most of the area comprising present-day Jerusalem was not part of the city, west or east, but rather part of the West Bank. The new borders, set by a committee headed by General Rehavam Ze'evi, then assistant to the head of the operations branch of the Israel Defense Forces General Staff, were approved by Israel's government. In setting the borders, the committee's objective was to strengthen Israeli sovereignty over the city by creating a Jewish majority. Thus, demographic considerations were decisive, and planning considerations were only of secondary importance. In order to ensure a significant Jewish majority, the primary consideration was to prevent the inclusion of heavily populated Palestinian areas within Jerusalem. Whereas several Palestinian villages were placed outside the city, some of their lands were included within the city's new borders, examples being Beit Iksa and Beit Hanina in the north, and detached areas lying in the municipalities of Bethlehem and Beit Sahur in the south. Villages and neighborhoods were, therefore, divided. One part remained in the West Bank and the other part was annexed by Israel. After the annexation, Israel conducted a census in these areas and granted permanent residency status to residents in the annexed areas present at the time the census was taken. Persons not present in the city, for whatever reason, forever lost their right to reside in Jerusalem. Permanent residents are permitted. Permanent residents are permitted if they wish and meet certain conditions to receive Israeli citizenship. These conditions include swearing allegiance to the state, proving that they are not citizens of any other country, and showing some knowledge of the Hebrew language. For political reasons, most of the residents do not request Israeli citizenship. Setting the municipal boundary to run through neighborhoods and villages also created a distinction between Palestinians regarding their rights, since residents living in the unannexed area continued to be residents of the West Bank and were subject to military rule. Palestinians hold the status of, quote, permanent resident of the State of Israel. This is the same status granted to foreign citizens who have freely chosen to come to Israel and want to live there. which is to say, I might add, virtually all Jewish individuals. Israel treats Palestinian residents of East Jerusalem as immigrants who live in their homes at the beneficence of the authorities and not by right. The authorities maintain this policy, although these Palestinians were born in Jerusalem, lived in the city, and have no other home. Treating these Palestinians as foreigners who entered Israel is astonishing, since it was Israel that entered East Jerusalem in 1967. Last paragraph. Permanent residency differs substantially from citizenship. The primary right granted to permanent residents is to live and work in Israel without the necessity of special permits. Permanent residents are also entitled to social benefits provided by the National Insurance Institute and to health insurance. Permanent residents have the right to vote in local elections, but not in elections to the Knesset or the Israeli parliament. I'm going to read that again. That flies in the face of so much that we Americans have heard for so long. Talking about Jerusalem, permanent residents have the right to vote in local elections, but not in elections to the Knesset or parliament. Unlike citizenship, permanent residency is only passed on to the holder's children, where the holder meets certain conditions. A permanent resident with a non-resident spouse must submit, on behalf of the spouse, a request for family unification. Only citizens are granted the right to return to Israel at any time. Now, that's the first part of the update of the situation in Jerusalem. Let's see. This was put out by, once again, I neglected to headline this sucker. Legal status of East Jerusalem and its residents. Oh, you know who this is from, folks? It's from Betzalem. Betzalem, which is the leading Israeli human rights group in Israel, which faithfully documents crimes and other misdemeanors, as it were, committed by both Israelis and Palestinians. Betzalem is consistently critical of Hamas when it fires missiles into southern Israel or central Israel. They are critical of crimes committed by Palestinians, regardless of where they occur. But they are, by and large, and by far, critical and sharp-eyed when it comes to these major policy crimes and other smaller, perhaps more intimately deadly crimes by the Israel Defense Forces and by the Israeli government. Betzalem put this out. It's 4:36 p.m. on the west coast of North America. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. Did I say four? It's 3:36. 3:36 p.m. on the west coast of North America in Santa Cruz, California. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, streaming live on freakradio.org. In addition to my archives, which are available at radioforall.net and santacruzindiebay.org, at least the previous week's show, in the case of the latter, Indie Bay. My shows are broadcast, rebroadcast a number of times at more or less odd hours in the course of the week. It is 3:37 Pacific Daylight Time. Let's go to this other article that I have on the status of Jerusalem. This is also from B'Tselem, Israel's leading human rights group, which is run and peopled by Israelis, Israeli Jews, who are sincerely interested in peace and justice for everyone, Palestinians and Israelis alike. B'Tselem writes, revocation of residency in East Jerusalem. Published all, this was originally published 1 January 2011, 2 years ago. And they saw fit to republish it this year on January 16. It says, between December 1995 and March 2000, Israel used an additional method to attain its demographic objective. The Interior Ministry, which deals with the residency status of East Jerusalem's Palestinian residents, revoked residency from those who moved outside Jerusalem's municipal borders. Palestinians who were unable to prove that they had lived in Jerusalem in the past and continue to live there were compelled to leave their homes forever. They could not live or work in Israel, and they and their families lost their social benefits. The Israeli authorities never announced this policy and never warned Palestinians that by leaving Jerusalem, they were jeopardizing their status and right to return to live in their homes in the city. The policies of the Israeli government and the Jerusalem municipality, in a variety of spheres, led thousands of Palestinians to leave the city, many to reside in Jerusalem's suburbs, others in the West Bank and Jordan. Until 1995, moving outside the city limits did not affect their status as permanent residents in Israel. They maintained this status as long as they returned to Jerusalem to renew their exit permits at the Ministry of the Interior, which regularly renewed the permits. Only a continued stay of more than 7 years outside Jerusalem without having renewed their exit permits was liable to lead to revocation of residency status. Palestinians who moved to Jerusalem suburbs or elsewhere in the West Bank did not require exit permits and could live there for years without it affecting their status. I shall now embark upon a delicious beverage. Pardon me for a few seconds. That lightens the load on my throat a little bit. Where was I? Not affecting our status. In December 1995, without forewarning, the Ministry of the Interior changed its policy. The ministry claimed that permanent residency, unlike citizenship, is a matter of the circumstances in which the individual lives. And when these circumstances change, the permit granting permanent residency expires. Thus, every Palestinian who lived outside the city for a number of years lost their right to live in the city, and the ministry ordered them to leave their homes. The fact that they had returned to Jerusalem over the years and the ministry regularly renewed their exit permits and granted them additional services was insignificant. The ministry demanded proof that their, quote, center of life, end quote, was in Jerusalem. The standard of proof was high, and the ministry required that the individual provide numerous documents. According to official sources, permanent residency of more than 3,000 individuals, quote, expired since December 1995. 3,000 individuals. In March 2000, the Minister of the Interior, Netan Sharansky, submitted an affidavit to the High Court of Justice in which he stated that the, quote, quiet deportation, end quote, policy would cease. The affidavit stated that the ministry would return to operating according to the pre-December 95 policy, which is to say all residents of East Jerusalem who renewed their exit permits on time would maintain their permanent residency status, even if they live in Jordan or in another country. Also, permanent residency status would not be revoked from Jerusalem residents who move to Jerusalem suburbs or elsewhere in the West Bank and do not require exit permits. The minister also stated in his affidavit that residency would be returned to those whose status had been revoked, provided that they lived in Jerusalem for at least 2 years. In addition, the ministry reinstated the residency of hundreds of Palestinians whose residency had been revoked during the years that Israel implemented its revocation policy. However, in the years since, the Ministry of the Interior has persisted in revoking the permanent residency status of Palestinian residents of East Jerusalem, particularly in cases in which Palestinians had been granted citizenship or permanent residency in another country. In 2008, the ministry revoked the residency status of a record 4,577 Palestinians. Whereas, that was in 2008. Whereas in 2011, it revoked the residency of 101 Palestinians. End of article. The second Betzalem article, Revocation of Residency in Jerusalem, 16 January this year. Let me give you those phone numbers again, folks. Area code 831-427-3772. Line 2 is 469-3119. So as far as being an update on the first thing I read you by Mr. Fletcher Jr. of blackcommentator.com, 4 years ago he was warning everyone about, not merely warning them about what was coming, but indeed stating that it's already happening. Ethnic cleansing was alive and well and official by Israeli law. Ethnic cleansing on a most formal, official level against Palestinians who have lived for many decades, perhaps much, much longer, in the city of Jerusalem. Because Israel would like to see the city of Jerusalem as 100% Jewish, so-called undivided city, the so-called undivided capital of the state of Israel, even though Jerusalem is in fact divided by a variety of very interesting boundaries and restrictions, depending on who lives where. Indeed, Jerusalem is divided. The point of this, these two articles from Betzalem, is to follow up on what Mr. Fletcher was talking about in May of 2009, and in all of its complicated wordiness, Betzalem describes in excruciating detail what happens to Palestinian Arabs who live in Jerusalem, who may have a long family history in Jerusalem, as the ethnic cleansing of them and their countrymen and countrywomen continues. A lot of stuff to digest. Okay. It's 12 minutes before the hour. Mideast Madness is brought to you from 3 p.m. to 4:55 p.m. That ending time in order to make sure we can bring you the IMEMC's broadcast of Palestine Today, which is brought to you Monday through Friday. Mideast Madness is once a week, every Monday at 3 p.m. My name is Ren Tawil. Let's have a little more music. Take a musical break here. You can stand up, stretch, and make sure you have enough ink in your pens and paper aplenty to write down the information I give you. In case you were wondering, that was from the album entitled The Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection, which I have played for months on end on this show. That was entitled Fatima, or as I like to pronounce it, Fatima. Okay, this major crime I was alluding to some 50 minutes ago when I began this week's program. In 2008, I was visiting the Gaza Strip with some 43 other activists who, quite frankly, were very lucky to be able to enter Gaza the way we did. By sea. We sailed from the island nation of Cyprus, Larnaca, Cyprus, to the port of Gaza City unmolested by the Israeli Navy. That was August 23rd. We landed in the port of Gaza City August 23, 2008. Shortly, I became aware of a number of ongoing severe problems that Gazan society and that Gazan Palestinians were experiencing, and a number of impending problems. The one that struck me most dramatically was the fact that off the coast of Gaza, which lies on the Mediterranean Sea, the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, there in Gazan territorial waters, internationally recognized territorial waters, is a vast field under the sea of natural gas. There are other such pockets of natural gas to the north of this one, lying either in Israeli territorial waters or perhaps in international, recognized to be international waters. Of course, speculators have been looking at this for some time, and Israel has been seriously at work in preparing to exploit this natural resource. Gasoline and oil from all these other ecologically questionable sources being less and less available, or perhaps just plain too expensive to extradite, to extract, I mean. Well, perhaps you realize what I'm getting at. The Gazan territorial field of natural gas under the ground, under the sea, but what should be in their jurisdiction, is being threatened by takeover by Israel, who, using their usual excuse of not wanting to deal with or recognize what they call the terrorist government of Hamas, which controls Gaza. Well, you do indeed see what I'm getting at. Let's get to the first reading here. Beginning with the voice of one who also participated in one of the early voyages of the Free Gaza Movement, as did I. Unfortunately, she did not make it to the Gaza Strip by sea, because this was after Operation Cast Lead, which killed some 300 Palestinian children and many other unarmed Palestinian citizens when the Israeli invaded and massacred those. Cynthia McKinney, the Israeli Navy and $4 billion worth of natural gas off Gaza. By Ann Garrison, Global Research, July 14, 2009. Former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, on the Israeli Navy's circuitous route to shore. Aha. I believe this is the caption to a picture, which, of course, I do not have for you. Former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney on the Israeli Navy's circuitous route to shore with the spirit of humanity in tow, after her arrest with 21 other human rights activists while trying to deliver medical supplies, building materials, and children's toys to Gaza. Normally, I try to cut those captions out, but this one escaped me. Okay, article is called Cynthia McKinney, the Israeli Navy, and $4 billion worth of natural gas off Gaza. On June 30th, 2009... Israeli naval gunships surrounded the Spirit of Humanity, a boat used by the Free Gaza Movement in international waters, 60 miles off the coast of Israel. 60 miles. And arrested 21 activists from 11 countries, including former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. Of course, that's the United States state of Georgia, not the country. Who had boarded the Spirit of Humanity in Larnaca, Cyprus, with medical aid, toys, and building supplies, hoping to carry them to Gaza's besieged Palestinian population. They had hoped not only to deliver aid, but also to challenge the illegal blockade imposed by the Israeli government on Gaza. Upon her release and return, Cynthia McKinney spoke to WBAIX from New York's JFK Airport, where she reported that the Israeli Navy had towed the Spirit of Humanity, not directly to Port Ashdod, but on a circuitous route bypassing Gaza. This, she said, suggested that the Israeli Navy is engaged in activity that they do not want observed in the coastal waters off Gaza, known to be the site of billions of dollars worth of natural gas reserves. Barack Obama, in his speech proposing United States reconciliation with the Muslim world in Cairo, Egypt, on June 3, 2009, said nothing of the estimated $4 billion worth of natural gas off the coast of Gaza, or the oil and natural gas in Iraq, Iran, or Sudan, or the pipeline projects to move Central Asian oil and natural gas through Afghanistan and other parts of Central Asia. On June 30th of that year, Israeli Navy gunships surrounded the Spirit of Humanity, a boat used by the Free Gaza Movement in international waters 60 miles off the coast of Israel. Okay, yeah, I know, I've already read that to you. For some reason, the writing is repeated here. I don't know how that happened. Okay, I somehow managed to double print this short piece here, written by Ann Garrison of Global Research, July 14, 2009. I do have a final paragraph here. Here's former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney on the Israeli Navy's circuitous route to shore with the Spirit of Humanity in tow. She says, Israel has two oil and natural gas drilling platforms north of Gaza, which some believe they are using to slant drill into Gaza's natural gas reserves. Slant drilling. I'd first heard of that some 40 years ago when environmental wackos, as Mr. Limbaugh likes to call them, were suggesting that instead of having these dangerous, ecologically dangerous oil platforms floating on the ocean immediately above oil fields, that we slant drill from the shore, which at the time, anyway, it was believed to be more ecologically sensitive and wiser. But now, Congresswoman McKinney is suggesting that Israel is using the slant drill process for political purposes, not ecological ones. They want to drain Gaza's natural gas reserve, that resource which belongs to the people of Gaza by law, recognized law, and get to it first. That's the piece. Ann Garrison, by the way, is an examiner from San Francisco. That's a weird sentence. I think that refers to the the big city's newspaper, the San Francisco Examiner. Ann Garrison is an examiner from San Francisco. Perhaps she should read as a reporter for the SF Examiner. You can see Ann's articles on Ann's homepage. I don't know what that is. All right, that was just, that was an early piece dating back to July 1409. Once again, let's update things here with what I believe are more recent articles on the same subject, namely that of the natural gas. This is from Global Research. Israel authorizes mining of natural gas off Gaza shore in defiance of Palestinian sovereignty. Global Research, June 14, 2011. Okay. Yeah. 2 years later, 2011. June of 2011. Global Research editor's note. This is the real reason for the maritime blockade of Gaza. Gaza's offshore natural gas. Denying Palestine its right over Gaza territorial waters. Its rights over Gaza territorial waters is intent upon appropriating Gaza's extensive reserves of natural gas. This piece written by Michelle Chosadovsky, June 13, 2011. Tel Aviv, PNN, that's the Palestine News Network. The Israeli Ministry of Infrastructure has demanded permission from the gas company Nobel Energy to start working in developing the natural gas field that was found off the Gaza Strip shoreline under the pretext that Israel fears gas shortages in the coming year. In a press statement on Monday, the Israeli Ministry of Infrastructure said that it officially requested permission from Nobel Energy to submit a work program to dig and develop gas fields by July. That would be July of 2011, about a month later. The ministry explained that the reason official permission has been sought before digging the oil is because the field is close to the territorial waters of the Gaza Strip. Israel gets natural gas from Egypt through an agreement in which Israel pays less than internationally recognized prices to Egypt. My God. After the Egyptian uprising and the toppling of Hosni Mubarak, the Egyptian people demanded that the channeling of gas to Israel would be stopped until a new agreement could be reached so that the Egyptian people could benefit first from their natural resources. A large concentration of natural gas was found off the Gaza shoreline, and the British Gas Group, along with Lebanese partners, were given the right to dig there and sell the gas during an agreement that was signed in November 1999 with the Palestinian Authority. The British company had already set up two gas wells called Gaza Marine 1 and Gaza Marine 2. According to the British Gas Group, the natural reservoir off the coast, off the Gaza shore, is estimated at 1.5 trillion cubic meters at a net worth of around $4 billion U.S. dollars. However, Chosadovsky, a Canadian economist, estimated that the amount of gas in Palestine is much more, adding that it could make the future Palestinian state as rich as Kuwait, another Arab nation on the Arabian Gulf, due to the average population in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Noble Energy is a U.S.-based company based in New York that digs oil and natural gas internationally. Dmitry Dlyani, a Fatah top official of the PLO commented on the Israeli Ministry of Infrastructure decision as a license to steal the Gaza gas as part of Israeli attacks on Palestinian rights. Dilani demanded international protection for the Palestinian natural gas reservoir off the Gaza shore. So, folks, this is some 2.5 or 3 years after my visit to Palestine, to the Gaza Strip, and upon my first learning of these vast fields of natural gas, which rightfully belong, or the proceeds rightfully belong, to the Palestinian people. Sure enough, Israel, according to this report, is doing everything it can to circumvent and defy Palestinian rights to their own resources, their natural resources, and doing what they can to hide it from the world. And yes, I did say that this was written by Michel Chosudovsky, but then toward the end of the article, it mentions Mr. Chosudovsky. So he was the reporter of the information, but this source, Global Research, is reporting on Mr. Chosudovsky's material. Okay. Phone number is 831-427-3772, 469-3119. Please give me a call if you happen to be hearing this show. It would be nice to talk to someone. I'm all by myself here. And the other thing is, it'd be nice to know that somebody is listening to Mideast Madness, either on the airwaves or through the World Wide Web. Okay, I'm bringing up another browser here to see if I can get some idea of how many people might be listening on the internet. And as usual, it's taking its sweet time. Please consider sending your donations to Free Radio Santa Cruz. This ongoing exercise of civil disobedience so that we may dispense entertainment and vital information unimpinged by the government, unimpinged by the Federal Communications Commission. Please send your donations to FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. We do indeed appreciate anything that you can forward to us. Help us find a new location for our transmission tower in the highlands, which are found roughly at the perimeters of the city of Santa Cruz. Also help us find a studio for $300 or less per month. Go to our website or call me on those lines that I gave you and we'll talk about that. Okay. Okay, that's nice. That's very good. Okay, back to the show. It's 1612 hours. All right, it's 4:12 p.m. on the west coast of North America. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, streaming live at freeradio.org. One more piece about the natural gas situation and how Israel continues to utterly ignore the rights and well-being of the indigenous native Palestinian Arabs who were there first. from the Center for Research on Globalization, November 17, 2012. War and natural gas, the Israeli invasion and Gaza's offshore gas fields. The following article was first published by Global Research in January 2009 at the height of the Israeli bombing and invasion under Operation Cast Lead. The ongoing attack on Gaza, which envisages a ground invasion, which did occur back then, is from the point of view of Israeli military planners. The ongoing attack on Gaza, which envisaged a ground invasion, is, from the point of view of Israeli military planners, a follow-up to the December 2008 attack on Gaza. Again, material provided by Michel Josadovsky, November 17, 2012. War and natural gas, the Israeli invasion and Gaza's offshore gas fields. The December 2008 military invasion of the Gaza Strip by Israeli forces bears a direct relation to the control and ownership of strategic offshore gas reserves. This is a war of conquest. Discovered in 2000, in the year 2000, there are extensive gas reserves off the Gaza coastline. Here it is, folks. Here's the Smoking Gun article. British Gas, BG Group, and its partner, the Athens, Greece-based Consolidated Contractors International Company, or CCC, owned by Lebanon's Sabah and Khoury families, were granted oil and gas exploration rights in a 25-year agreement signed in November 1999 with the Palestinian Authority. The rights to the offshore gas field are respectively British Gas 60%, Consolidated Contractors, the CCC 30%, and the Investment Fund of the Palestinian Authority 10%. This, according to Haaretz publication, October 21, 2007. The PABG-CCC agreement, those three organizations, includes field development and the construction of a gas pipeline. This from Middle East Economic Digest, January 5, 2001. The BG license covers the entire Gazan offshore marine area, which is contiguous to several Israeli offshore gas facilities. It should be noted that 60% of the gas reserves along the Gaza-Israel coastline belong to Palestine. 60% of the gas reserves along the Gaza-Israel coastline belong to Palestine. The BG Group drilled two wells in 2000, Gaza Marine 1 and Gaza Marine 2. Reserves are estimated by British Gas to be of the order of 1.4 trillion cubic feet, valued at approximately $4 billion United States dollars. These are the figures made public by British Gas. The size of Palestine's gas reserves could be much larger. Who owns the gas fields? The issue of sovereignty over Gaza's gas fields is crucial. From a legal standpoint, the gas reserves belong to Palestine. The death of Yasser Arafat, the election of the Hamas government, and the ruin of the Palestinian Authority have enabled Israel to establish de facto control over Gaza's offshore gas reserves. British Gas, BG Group, has been dealing with the Tel Aviv government. In turn, the Hamas government has been bypassed in regards to exploration and development rights over the gas fields. The election of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, Prime Minister of Israel Ariel Sharon, in 2001 was a major turning point. Palestine's sovereignty over the offshore gas fields was challenged in the Israeli Supreme Court. Sharon stated unequivocally that, quote, Israel would never buy gas from Palestine, end quote, intimating that Gaza's offshore gas reserves belong to Israel. In 2003, Ariel Sharon vetoed an initial deal which would allow British gas to supply Israel with natural gas from Gaza's offshore wells. This from The Independent, August 19, 2003. The election victory of Hamas in 2006. Hamas, the government in control of the Gaza Strip, was conducive to the demise of the Palestinian Authority, which became confined to the West Bank under the proxy regime of Mahmoud Abbas. In 2006, British Gas, quote, was close to signing a deal to pump the gas to Egypt. From the Times, most likely the London Times, May 23rd, 2007. According to reports, British Prime Minister Tony Blair intervened on behalf of Israel with a view to shutting the agreement, with a view to shunting the agreement with Egypt. The following year, in May 2007, the Israeli cabinet approved a proposal by Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, quote, to buy gas from the Palestinian Authority. The proposed contract was for $4 billion, with profits of the order of $2 billion, of which $1 billion was to go to the Palestinians. Tel Aviv, the capital of Israel, however, had no intention on sharing the revenues with Palestine. An Israeli team of negotiators was set up by the Israeli cabinet to thrash out a deal with the BG group, bypassing both the Hamas government and the Palestinian Authority. Now, there is a quotation here. Israeli defense authorities want the Palestinians to be paid in goods and services and insist that no money go to the Hamas-controlled government. That quotation is also from, that would be from the Times, May 23rd, 2007. The objective was essentially to nullify the contract signed in 1999 between the BG Group and the Palestinian Authority under Yasser Arafat. Under the proposed 2007 agreement with BG, the British group, Palestinian gas from Gaza's offshore wells was to be channeled by an undersea pipeline to the Israeli seaport of Ashkelon, which is just north of the Gaza Strip. So close to the Gaza Strip that we saw the highest points of that city as we approached the port of Gaza in 2008. Palestinian gas from Gaza's offshore wells was to be channeled by an undersea pipeline to the Israeli seaport of Ashkelon, thereby transferring control over the sale of the natural gas to Israel. The deal fell through. The negotiations were suspended. Another quotation here. Quote, Mossad chief Meir Dagan opposed the transaction on security grounds that the proceeds would fund terror. End quote. Member of Knesset Gilad Erdan addressed to the Knesset on the intention of Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert to purchase gas from the Palestinians when payment will serve Hamas. The long title of that address, March 1st, 2006. Quoted in Lieutenant General retired Moshe Yalon, does the prospective purchase of British gas from Gaza's coastal waters threaten Israel's national security? Jerusalem Center of Public Affairs, 2007. Israel's intent was to foreclose the possibility that royalties be paid to the Palestinians in December 2007. The BG Group withdrew from the negotiations with Israel, and in January 2008, they closed their office in Israel, according to the BG website. This next section is entitled Invasion Plan on the Drawing Board. Smoke and gun stuff. The invasion plan of the Gaza Strip under Operation Cast Lead was set in motion in June 2008, according to Israeli military sources. And I quote here, sources in the defense establishment said Defense Minister Ehud Barak instructed the Israel Defense Forces to prepare for the operation over 6 months ago, June or even before June. Before Operation Cast Lead began. Even as Israel was beginning to negotiate a ceasefire agreement with Hamas, end quote. This by Barak Ravid. Operation Cast Lead Israeli Air Force strike followed months of planning. An article that also appeared in the Israeli circular Haaretz, December 27, 2008. December 27 was the beginning of that so-called war. It was in reality more of a de facto massacre. It was a massacre. See, Hamas simply has no military which can begin to compare to the might and power of the IDF, Israel's so-called defense forces. I refer to them as the IOF, Israel Occupation Forces, or Israel Offense Forces. That very same month, the Israeli authorities contacted British Gas with a view to resuming crucial negotiations pertaining to the purchase of Gaza's natural gas. Quote, both Ministry of Finance Director General Yaron Ariav and Ministry of National Infrastructure's Director General Hezi Kugler agreed to inform BG of Israel's wish to renew the talks. The sources added that BG, the British group, has not yet officially responded to Israel's request. But that company executives would probably come to Israel in a few weeks to hold talks with government officials. This from Globes Online, Israel's Business Arena, June 23, 2008. The decision to speed up negotiations with British Gas, the BG Group, coincided chronologically with the planning of the invasion of Gaza initiated in June. It would appear that Israel was anxious to reach an agreement with the BG Group prior to the invasion, which was already in an advanced planning stage. Moreover, these negotiations with British Gas were conducted by the Ehud Olmert government with the knowledge that a military invasion was on the drawing board. In all likelihood, a new, quote, post-war political territorial arrangement for the Gaza Strip was also being contemplated by the Israeli government. A post-war political territorial arrangement for the Gaza Strip. In fact, negotiations between between British Gas and Israeli officials were ongoing in October 2008, 2 to 3 months prior to the commencement of the bombings on December 27th. In November 2008, the Israeli Ministry of Finance and the Ministry of National Infrastructures instructed Israel Electric Corporation, IEC, to enter into negotiations with British Gas on the purchase of natural gas from the BG's offshore concession in Gaza. From Globes, November 13, 2008. Here's a direct quote from that source. Ministry of Finance Director General Yaron Ariav and Ministry of National Infrastructure Director General Hezi Kugler wrote to IEC. IEC CEO Amos Lasker recently informing him of the government's decision to allow negotiations to go forward in line with the framework proposal it approved earlier this year. Continuing with quotation, the IEC board, headed by Chairman Moti Friedman, approved the principles of the framework proposal a few weeks ago. The talks with BG Group will begin once the board approves the exemption from a tender, end quote. Again, that's from Globes, November 2008. Final subheading, Gaza and energy geopolitics. The military occupation of Gaza, Israel's military occupation, is intent upon transferring the sovereignty of the gas fields to Israel in violation of international law. What can we expect in the wake of the invasion? What is the intent of Israel with regard to Palestine's natural gas reserves? A new territorial arrangement with the stationing of Israeli and or, quote, peacekeeping troops? The militarization of the entire Gaza coastline, which is strategic for Israel? Or perhaps the outright confiscation of Palestinian gas fields and the unilateral declaration of Israeli sovereignty over Gaza's maritime areas? If this were to occur, the Gaza gas fields would be integrated into Israel's offshore installations, which are contiguous to those of the Gaza Strip. These various offshore installations are also linked up to Israel's energy transport corridor extending from the port of Eilat, which is an oil pipeline terminal on the Red Sea, to the seaport, to pipeline terminal in Ashkelon, Israel, and northwards to Haifa, Israel, and eventually linking up through a proposed Israeli-Turkish pipeline with the Turkish port of Ceyhan. Ceyhan is the terminal of the Baku-Tbilisi Ceyhan Trans-Caspian Pipeline. Quote, what is envisaged is to link the BTC pipeline to the Trans-Israel Eilat Ashkelon Pipeline, also known as Israel's TIP Line. See Michael Chosedovsky, The War on Lebanon and the Battle for Oil, Global Research, July 23, 2007. End of article. A little bit about the author. Michel Chosedovsky is an award-winning author, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Ottawa, Ottawa, Canada, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, CRG, Montreal, and editor of the globalresearch.ca website. He is the author of The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, 2003, and America's, quote, War on Terrorism, 2005. His most recent book is entitled Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War, in 2011, published 2011. He is also a contributor to the Encyclopedia Britannica. His writings have been published in more than 20 languages. He can be reached at crgeditor@yahoo.com. That's CRG for Well, there's so many terms here, it's hard to even find, even when I'm looking right at it. Okay, well, folks, it's 4:31 p.m. here, Pacific Daylight Time. This is the Mideast Madness Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I am Ren. 3 items about the Palestinian gas fields off Gaza, in Gazan territorial waters, with links as far back as the year 2000 or 2001 concerning Israel's sinister attempts to bypass all questions and answers of Palestinian sovereignty over their mineral, over their natural resources. You've heard me read to you how some higher-ups in Israel worry that any monetary benefit, any monies gained by the Hamas government of Gaza will only lead to more terrorism against Israel. In my mind, that immediately brings to my mind, the fact that some Israelis and supporters of Israel have suggested, and I'm sure this is all from information sourced in Israel itself through their websites and their contacts, complaints from Israelis that, Hamas could have had a glorious economy in the Gaza Strip if they would only not invest so much in missiles and invest in everything else that they need. Of course, the only reason why the Gazans fire missiles into Israel is they are pinched half to death by economic and military restrictions against Israel, against the Gaza Strip by the Israelis, by a deliberate attempt of Israeli sources of food and supply and medicine and spare parts for infrastructure by Israel, the deliberate restricting of those to, as the Israelis have put Gaza on a diet. That came out of WikiLeaks, folks. Again, not something you pick out of mainstream or even semi-mainstream media from any source. It had to be dug out through the efforts of Julian Assange and his WikiLeaks outfit. So the authorities in the Gaza Strip not being able to manage or run an effective thriving economy, not because they're stupid and don't know how, but because Israel won't let them. Israel is going further by stealing their natural resources in their territorial waters. So the people, those Israelis who are yelling, Hamas should concentrate less on killing Israelis and more on supporting their own people. I've been to the Gaza Strip, folks. Me, Ren Tawil. I see what they contend with, what they've had to contend with. A lot of idleness out there. Grown men who simply sit in their houses or out front, in front of their homes. A dead atmosphere. Children not always able to go to school, running around in the narrow streets of Beitz refugee camp. Yes, there is some commerce. There has to be something for people to do in order to keep their sanity and to at least attempt to feed their families. But Israel looks at those same busy pedestrian clogged streets and says, look, they're thriving. They have a thriving economy. It's all superficial. Gaza is starving. Gaza's children are suffering from various forms of environmental pollution because it's impossible ultimately to keep the kids from swimming in the sea there, and the excrement, the pollution that goes immediately into the Mediterranean Sea from Gaza's industrial facilities is not being treated because they can't afford or simply cannot acquire repair parts for their treatment sewage. That kind of thing. I've been to the hospital, Shifa Hospital, in Gaza City, where 5 years ago when I was there, as of then, they had only, I believe, three or four kidney dialysis machines because the rest of them needed spare parts. So they couldn't use them. And there was a lineup of those needing kidney dialysis treatment. And I believe some of those kidney patients suffer, that their kidneys have suffered from a lack of proper nutrition and exposure to those environmental pollutants. And Israel knows they're dying off slowly under those conditions. But only brings attention to those terrible missiles coming from northern Gaza. By the way, B'Tselem and other groups, human rights groups, admit and proclaim that the firing of missiles from Gaza into Israel is an international criminal act. It has to be viewed as such, along with Israel's military criminal acts. The only thing is, I, for one, and a few others that I've been reading from recently, are having a harder and harder time arguing with Gaza about their lack of enforcement against those many splinter groups that are firing, groups separate from Hamas government, that are firing the missiles. We're having a harder and harder time and not feeling comfortable admonishing those groups, admonishing the Palestinians from taking those freedom fighter acts. They consider themselves to be freedom fighters. And of course, if you don't agree with their point of view, they are terrorists. That's an old story. Okay. A lot of details I've just conveyed to you about who owns what and what percent, 60%, 30%, the Palestinian Authority getting 10% of proceeds from their own fields that they own some 60% of. They're according to the agreement forced upon them, not having a lot of leeway either way, that the PA has 10% of rights on their own offshore gas fields, that they have over half of it under their jurisdiction, under their political jurisdiction, or supposed to have it. And there is this awful, eye-opening connection between Operation Cast Lead in late 2008, 2009, where over 1,000 Palestinians were killed in the Israeli bombings, which included white phosphorus chemical bombings that they get from the United States and are not supposed to use against civilians in scenarios such as that, according to their own agreement with the U.S. government. And the U.S. government continues to turn a blind eye to that crime. All right, now. Perhaps we'll be hearing more about this in the big city newspapers. Might have to dig away at a back section to find it in the mainstream politics. I'm looking for something to shift into here. A slight change of pace. A friend of mine, one of the freelance journalists, Steve Greaves, who I believe resides at least part-time in California, he was there on Cyprus in Nicosia, where we were staying, Steve Greaves, he often emails us, other people on the Free Gaza list, other eye-opening, noteworthy pieces on the situation there. He broke from his usual practice and says, "Enjoy this poem of linguistic questions with questionable answers." And then Google more George Carlin YouTube video clips if you need to. If you need to lift your spirits or rage at our government while laughing, too. Cheers, Steve. Cartoon picture of George Carlin, 1937 to 2008, I guess. Yes, he did pass away, if you've forgotten or didn't hear to begin with. The English plural according to poetry. We'll begin with the box, and the plural is boxes, but the plural of ox becomes oxen, not oxes. One fowl is a goose, but two are called geese. Yet the plural of moose should never be meese. You may find a lone mouse or a nest full of mice, yet the plural of house is houses, not heis. If the plural of man is always called men, why shouldn't the plural of pan be called pen? If I speak of my foot and show you my feet, and I give you a boot, would a pair be called beet? If one is a tooth and a whole set of teeth, why shouldn't the plural of booth be called beeth? Then one may be that, and there would be those. Yet hat in the plural would never be hose. And the plural of cat is cats, not coes. We speak of a brother and also a brethren. But though we say mother, we never say methren. Then the masculine pronouns are he, his, and him. But imagine the feminine, she, shiz, and shim. Let's face it, English is a crazy language. There is no egg in eggplant, nor ham in hamburger, neither apple nor pine in pineapple. English muffins weren't invented in England. We take English for granted, but if we explore its paradoxes, we find that quicksand can work slowly, boxing rings are square, and a guinea pig is neither from Guinea, nor is it a pig. And why is it that writers write, but fingers don't fight, don't fing? Writers write, but fingers don't fing. Grocers don't gross, and hammers don't ham. Some interesting cartoons here between the paragraphs. Animations. Doesn't it seem crazy that you can make amends, but not one amend? If you have a bunch of odds and ends and get rid of all but one of them, what would you call it? If teachers taught, why didn't preachers prot? If a vegetarian eats vegetables, what does a humanitarian eat? If a vegetarian eats vegetables, what does a humanitarian eat? Sometimes I think all the folks who grew up speaking English should be committed to an asylum for the verbally insane. In what other language do people recite at a play and play at a recital? We ship by truck but send cargo by ship. We have noses that run and feet that smell. We park in a driveway and drive in a parkway. And how can a slim chance and a fat chance be the same, while a wise man and a wise guy are opposites? You have to marvel at the unique lunacy of a language in which your house can burn up as it burns down, in which you fill in a form by filling it out, and in which an alarm goes off by going on. And in closing, says Mr. Carlin, if father is pop, how come mother is not mop? Hardy har har. Again, for my friend Steve Greaves. Independent journalist, freelance journalist. Extraordinaire. It's been a while since I've heard from him. This just came in. All right. Back to business. No more fun. You only have 7 minutes left anyway. 7 minutes of this show, Mideast Madness, which comes to you every Monday starting at 3 p.m. 1500 hours Pacific Daylight Time. I want to remind everyone that Dr. Jeff Halper, Ph.D., co-founder and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, presents a talk, A Binational State in Israel-Palestine, Imagine the Future. Let me tell you about my friend Dr. Halper. Dr. Halper has been a peace and human rights activist for more than three decades. Born in Minnesota, he participated in the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War movements of the 1960s. In Israel, Halper taught anthropology at Haifa and Ben-Gurion universities. He is the author of Between Redemption and Revival, The Jewish Yishuv in Jerusalem in the 19th century. Let me explain. The term Yishuv is Hebrew, which is their word for the ancient Jews who have lived continuously in Palestine, or mostly continuously since ancient times. A very small minority of the Palestine population until the Zionist settler movement began in earnest in the very late 1800s. In 1997, Halper co-founded the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions, or House Demolitions, ICAD, ICAHD, to challenge and resist the Israeli policy of demolishing Palestinian homes. That the demolishing of their homes is one of the higher profile crimes that Israel continues to cause to fall upon the Palestinian people, again, virtually always in contradiction to international law. Israel-Palestine, a binational state, with Dr. Jeff Halper, Sunday, April 14. That's next Sunday, 7:30 p.m. The address is 612 Ocean Street, Santa Cruz. Yes, folks, that's the Resource Center for Nonviolence, Santa Cruz, California. A $5 to $10 donation is requested, but no one will be turned away for lack of funds. We recognize the high educational potential for these events. Please don't make it a point not to come because you happen to be broke. It's a great educational learning experience. Actually, the event is co-sponsored by the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILPF, and the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Couple of other interesting things. I met Dr. Halper on Cyprus in 2008. In fact, we were buddied up on the voyage to Gaza. As we both, he was born in Minnesota, and I was living in Minnesota at the time, actually. So he was kind of fascinated with that and suggested that we keep an eye on one another during the treacherous, perilous seasickening voyage on the high seas, the Mediterranean Sea, into Gaza City. Yeah, Halper immigrated to Israel in 1979. Very tiny writing here, so I've struggled to get this out. He immigrated to Israel in 73 after attending rabbinical school and resisting military service in the Vietnam War that the United States was fighting. Remember, he was born in Israel. He was born in Minnesota. In Israel, Halper taught anthropology. His academic research is focused on the history of Jerusalem in the modern era, contemporary Israeli culture, and the Middle East conflict. He is the author of Between Redemption and Revival, The Jewish Yeshuv in Jerusalem in the 19th Century, as I stated. During his mandatory Israeli military service, he refused to bear arms or serve in the occupied Palestinian territories. In 1997, Halper co-founded the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions to challenge and resist the Israeli policy of demolishing Palestinian homes because they feel like it and want to make room for more Jewish settlers. While I was handing out flyers yesterday on the mall here on the main drag in Santa Cruz, there was one person who didn't see eye to eye with us, but she was smiling the whole time. And as soon as we told her about the boycott against SodaStream, which is made in the settlements at the expense of native Palestinian Arabs, as soon as she heard us say the word settlement, she perked up and said, "You know what the settlements are? Those are suburbs." She said, "They're just suburbs." And of course, my first response to her was, "Except it's on land that doesn't belong to them." And she simply said, "It does belong to them." And she walked away. She walked away, refusing to read the brochures we were trying to pass out to people. That's semantics, lady. You can view things in whatever language you prefer, using whatever phraseology you prefer. Calling a Jewish settlement an illegal Jewish settlement in militarily occupied land against world opinion in an oppressive military occupation, such a settlement is not merely a suburb, although it definitely extends the civilian as well as the military life of Israel into land that does not belong to them. Folks, it's 4:55 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Continue to boycott SodaStream. It's just not right. They shouldn't be selling it in America. They shouldn't even be making it. And I'll talk at you next Monday starting at 3 p.m. Keep listening. Donate to Free Radio Santa Cruz. And now here is IMEMC's Palestine Today. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, April 8, 2013. Two Palestinian civilians injured by Israeli troops' gunfire and soldiers attack an anti-wall and settlement protest. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A journalist and a Palestinian worker were reported injured on Monday by Israeli army gunfire in two separate incidents in the West Bank. Mohammed Al-Azza, 23 years old, a photojournalist, was hit in the face as he was covering clashes between invading Israeli soldiers and Palestinian youth at Aida refugee camp in the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem on Monday afternoon. Medical sources said that Mohammed were moved to a nearby hospital in critical conditions after one of the Israeli soldiers shot him in the face with a rubber-coated steel bullet. Many others were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Meanwhile, a Palestinian worker was shot and injured by Israeli troops' live gunfire near the northern West Bank city of Nablus on Monday evening. The man was injured when Israeli troops opened fire at a group of Palestinian workers working at a construction site just outside Nablus city. The army gave no reason for shooting at the workers. Earlier on Monday morning, Israeli troops attacked a nonviolent protest organized by villagers and their international and Israeli supporters at the village of Beit Umar, southern West Bank. Residents were protesting the Israeli wall and settlements built on lands stolen by the Israeli army from local farmers. Soldiers used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to attack the unarmed protesters. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Moreover, one international supporter was arrested by the Israeli army during the protest. On Monday at dawn, two residents were kidnapped by Israeli troops who invaded the village of Sorif, also southern West Bank. Residents announced that troops invaded the village, searched homes, and then took the two men away without giving any reasons. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, April 8th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassam Kassis and me, Ghassam Bannoura.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, April 8th, 2013.
This horrendous explosion went overhead and slammed into the backside of one of the whales, and it exploded and she screamed.
How can we ever stop the clear cuts in the forest if we're so effective at clear cutting one another?
To recognize one's own insanity is, of course, the arising of sanity.
Mother Mary, come to me.
All of our life, all over our Mother Earth. We know that the cancer rate has gone up to epidemic proportions because of the fallout in the air, in the atmosphere, in the water.
It's a small world.
Tune in to Small World Radio. Thursdays from 2 to 3 p.m.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, April 8th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, WikiLeaks releases a database of nearly 2 million U.S. diplomatic documents. It's the group's largest publication to date. Protests against the U.S. targeted killing program continue as activists and faith groups highlight the CEOs and companies profiting from drone manufacturing. And we'll go to Bolivia, where violent attacks on women have sparked protests and legislative action. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Margaret Thatcher, Britain's longest-serving prime minister of the 20th century, died today. President Obama paid tribute, saying, quote, "America has lost a true friend." Her hardline approach earned her a nickname, the Iron Lady, but it also garnered numerous critics. In 1980, she famously declared,
"You turn if you want to. The lady's not for turning."
In 1981, she refused to negotiate with hunger-striking Irish Republican prisoners who wanted to be recognized as political prisoners. The hunger strike ended only after 10 prisoners starved to death. Abroad, her belligerent approach was evident when she ordered military action to retake the tiny British territory of the Falkland Islands. In 1982, Argentina invaded the islands in the South Atlantic. Nearly 800 soldiers from both sides died. Many political analysts say Thatcher is the force that shifted British politics to the right. Current Prime Minister David Cameron continues many of the policies she introduced. During her 11 years in office, she oversaw widespread privatization of state-run services and fought bitter battles to weaken British trade unions. Riots over what became known as a poll tax were part of what hastened her exit from office. Margaret Thatcher died following a stroke. She was 87. There's no official word from NATO yet on reports that 11 Afghan children were killed in an ISAF airstrike in Kunar province on Saturday. Pictures reportedly of the children show them lined up on the ground,